to self-care for field-based outreach workers. I am Danielle Farmer. I am one of the lead community mental health trainers here on the team. I'm a licensed clinical social worker, and I have about 13 years of experience in the fields of education and social work. And so in my roles as a teacher, a counselor, a social worker, they've all kind of been direct practice focused. But what I found is that just given the nature of trauma that clients were bringing in, that families were bringing in, that staff were bringing in, a huge part of all of my roles really became focusing on supporting staff mental health, including my own, especially my own, right? And so I picked up a lot of tips along the way just of ways to support your mental health when you're out in the field, when you're doing outreach field-based work. And so I'm really excited to share those with you today. So before we get started, I really want to clarify, you know, what this space is today and what it's not. So what it is today is really an opportunity for you to learn about burnout, the impacts of job-related stress, but it is not a reason to shame yourself for how you're currently handling stress. I think sometimes when we have these trainings on self-care and ways to take care of yourself, it can feel really overwhelming. And it can feel like when you hear about the do's and don'ts, we can easily focus on the things that we're doing that are part of the don'ts, right? And so I really want you to give yourself grace to know that you're currently handling stress however you can, the best way you can. And hopefully today, we can just add a few more tools to your toolkit. So in that same vein, today you'll get exposure to a lot of different tools, a lot of different practices, but this is not a mandate to try everything. You should not try everything that I throw at you today. I really encourage you not to overwhelm yourself by trying to try everything. It's really just an exposure to a menu of strategies and different ways that you can take care of yourself, and most likely that you're already and you and your organization are already doing. Today is an opportunity to reflect on how more systemic things may be impacting your mental health, but it's not a space to, you know, make systemic changes. So sorry about that. You know, although we do partner with DMH, you know, I'm not part of DMH leadership, so I can't come into your organization and change things for you as much as I wish that I could. But what I can do is really give you tools to recognize when systemic things are at play and hopefully give you the tools and the motivation to advocate for yourself to make those larger changes when you think that they're impacting your ability to care for yourself. And then finally, this is a space to process and plan for your own wellness. I know that all of you are amazing, amazing providers, and self-care really is a parallel process, right? So a lot of the things that you're going to be learning about how to do for yourself can also definitely work for your clients, right? And can work and be part of their treatment plan and be part of how they take care of themselves. But I really want you to focus on you primarily today, that you are the primary person that you are thinking of and that you're focusing on when you think about these strategies. So really putting yourself in the front seat for these next 2 hours and your mental health being the focus. All right. So before we jump straight into the content of the training, I'm going to lead us in a brief grounding exercise. I know it's right after lunch. You might be coming from various meetings or being out in the field. And so sometimes it's nice just to kind of orient yourself to the space and have a chance just to sit down and ground yourself before we get started and kind of get your brain ready to be in learning mode. You can watch the video, you can close your eyes, however you feel comfortable, you can engage in the video.
This is a short, guided, 2-minute meditation for beginners. Wherever you are, take this moment to soften your gaze and relax your shoulders down away from your ears. And as you're ready, begin to bring awareness to your breath. Not changing it in any way just yet. Just noticing what your natural breath sounds like. And noticing what it feels like. Perhaps also observing where it's coming from in the body. And as you're ready, inhale through your nose to fill the belly. And exhale out of the mouth, empty the belly. Inhale, fill the belly, feel it rise toward your heart. And then exhale, empty the belly, feel it fall. Now, I invite you to take another couple rounds on your own, just as we've practiced. As you're ready, return to your easy, natural breath and begin to bring awareness to your body, wiggling your fingers, your toes, and gently opening your eyes, refocusing on the space around you, and preparing to move through the rest of your day. And I invite you to carry this short practice with you.
So hopefully that can just kind of help put you in a calm space, a learning space for our time together today. A big part of our training in the beginning, we'll be talking about traumatic and toxic stress and things that could be uncomfortable and can be difficult to sit through. So I really want you to make sure that you're monitoring yourself, taking care of your needs as they arise. All right, so our learning objectives for today, what we'll be doing is I will highlight some statistics, and trends regarding work-related stress. We'll discuss situations that can trigger traumatic stress and the impact that this stress can have on our brain, our body, and our emotional well-being. I'm going to define some common terms used to define burnout and other related concepts. I'm going to discuss the history of self-care for a little while and just how it relates to you specifically as outreach workers. And then we'll spend a lot of time reviewing self-care practices, really trying to be as comprehensive and holistic as possible. And then at the end, if I can keep my pacing on a good note, we'll have lots of time for you to have work time so that you can create your own individualized wellness plan so that you're not just walking away with just ideas, but that you have time to put it down on paper. All right. So when we think about self-care, it really has become a buzzword, I think, especially since the pandemic. And when we think about frontline workers, such as in, you know, healthcare, social services, the education field, we hear about self-care. It's important to take care of yourself, self-care. And we hear it from our managers, we hear it from the media, we hear it from our colleagues, right? It's everywhere. Probably, I'm sure part of your onboarding training, there was something about self-care and the importance of taking care of yourself. And so why is it so necessary, right? Right. Why has it become such a popular term? And so a few numbers that I thought, you know, were really harrowing that stuck out to me is that 83% of workers suffer from work-related stress. So a good majority of people who are in the workforce in America right now, these numbers are all for American workforce, suffer from stress related directly to their job. And about a fourth of people say that their job is the number one stressor in their lives over everything else. And so when we think about kind of the ripple effects that this has, we see that about 1 million people miss work every day just due to work-related stress. And about 3/4 of people report that work stress affects other areas of their life, especially their personal relationships. And then about half of people say that they lose about 15 to 30 minutes a day of productivity just due to being stressed out, with about a third saying it's more like an hour a day, but just because of the stress that they're experiencing, their productivity has just gone way down. So I want to stop and engage if this feels true. When you hear these numbers, when you hear how stressed out people are because of their job, does this feel true to you? Or does this feel like workplace stress really is that prevalent just based on your experiences? So feel free to unmute yourself. You can type it into the chat, whatever you feel comfortable with. But does this feel true to you? So I see a lot of yeses, exclamation points. Yes, it's true. Unfortunately, right? Yeah. So a lot of agreement, a lot of yeses, absolutely, which is so unfortunate, right? It's so unfortunate that we know that this is when we hear these numbers, there's no guess to it. There's no second guessing it, or I don't know if that's not really true for my job, right? It's we understand why the numbers are the way they are. There's a lot of agreement in the chat. So I really appreciate you all kind of chiming in, and that unfortunately this is a reality that we're faced with, right? And so again, we don't always have the power to make these kind of systemic changes for, you know, what labor and work looks like in our country sometimes. But what we can do is think about the ways that we are equipping our bodies and the ways that we are handling stress on our own. And so let's get into the social services field specifically, because these numbers were in general for kind of all workers. So when we think about the social service world, there was an interesting study that happened in 2005 where they looked at work-related stress for about 26 different jobs. And they found that 6 jobs specifically had worse than average scores, meaning that they were the most stressful jobs. So in no particular order, those 6 were EMTs, teachers, prison officers, police officers, call center customer service representatives. And then the 6th one, of course, you guessed it, social service providers, right? So that's us. That's the people who are doing this field-based work, working with clients, interacting every day. And so when they looked at what causes this, right, what are some factors that cause these jobs to be the most stressful jobs, and specifically social service providers, there were a few things that came up. The first is this idea of emotional labor. And so what that means is there are certain jobs that require face-to-face or maybe on the phone, voice-to-voice interaction with clients. And so in these jobs, the emotions that you have to use to guide your interactions, so things like empathy, patience, restraint, right, all of your interactions with other people, they follow these strict rules, right? They don't flow like natural conversations and that we use outside of work in real life. There are ways that you have to interact with them, ways you have to respond to their questions, ways that you have to ask questions to get information and to meet your goals, right? It's very scripted and a prescriptive ways of talking to clients. And so that can be really, really taxing. And they found that type of emotional labor and that type of way of conversing with people all day can really, really contribute to stress. Threat of violence was found to be another factor for social service providers. Factors that impact other social service agents, that affect many social service agencies, so things like high caseload, team conflict, inadequate supervision, unclear policies and procedures, those are things that contributed to stress. And then there are things that are specific to Los Angeles that really make, especially people who work in housing, it makes their job a lot harder, right? So like housing costs here, availability and long wait list for either shelters or housing providing or mental health services, right? All of those things specific to Los Angeles can really contribute to stress. And then finally, just the realities of working with people either experiencing homelessness or experiencing high levels of trauma. So, you know, these populations are more at risk for assault or death due to violence, drug overdoses, and other forms of traumatic events. And so, therefore, that means that you as outreach providers, as social service providers, are exposed to these traumatic things more frequently, which definitely contributes to work-related stress. So when you look at this list, when you hear about these factors, do these feel true to you, or are there any that you would add? Are there any that feel specific to outreach providers that makes you specifically more at risk for experiencing stress in the workplace? Again, feel free to use the chat or unmute yourself. And then in the chat, she said, I would be curious to know how many take family medical leave due to work stress. In my experience, I've seen a lot, most of the people, aside from, you know, having a baby kind of being maybe the number one reason I've seen it, I would say number 2 is stress leave. So I think unfortunately, it's really prevalent for people to use medical leave for mental health reasons. And a lot of that mental health comes from work-related stress. So it's a really good point. So some more factors that people are adding in the chat: commute, definitely, especially being in LA, right? Traffic, we know that that could look different for us in LA versus maybe other cities or other states. Dealing with crises, absolutely. Yep, inadequate compensation, pay. I agree with you. I'm surprised that wasn't on the list as well, because we know that pay for social service workers does not match the emotional labor, right, that goes into the work. And so I definitely agree with you. Negative interactions with other systems, other county systems like police, firefighter, EMT, ongoing change, dealing with coworkers. Yep. High caseload, absolutely. So lots of factors. So it's understandable to see why social service work is one of these top six stressful jobs, right? We can name a lot of factors that can contribute to this, seeing the constant suffering each day. Absolutely. I will definitely get into that a little bit more in a couple slides as well. So when we think about stress, I want to zoom out a little bit and just kind of come up with some common definitions and talk about stress itself for a little bit. So this graph shows how our performance, and this could be across anything. This could be our work performance, this could be our social performance, just us in general, but how we perform, how that is impacted by rising levels of stress. So, you know, and I'm sure we've heard, right, in high school science, right, but science, stress isn't always a bad thing, right? We know that, in fact, in small doses, stress can all often enhance our performance, and we can use it to guide our learning and to use as part of our motivation. So when we think about this good stress, that's here in the yellow. Hopefully you can see my cursor. But right here in the yellow is the good stress, or it's called eustress. And so this happens in situations where we feel excited about something, maybe like an upcoming date or a positive change in our family, or things like a speech or an athletic competition where we're feeling confident in our abilities. We're a little nervous, but we're using that adrenaline to fuel our performance. So that's the kind of good stress. Those are things, those are ways that stress shows up that helps us. And on the top, we can see how they kind of, on the top of this curve, we see how they impact our well-being, right? And so in the yellow, these things that are positive, although they're positive events, they can still cause some fatigue, right? They still take some mental energy from us. They still require a lot of our capacity, so they can lead to a little bit of fatigue. But as the stress gets higher, it can lead to negative stress. And this is what we think of more frequently when we think of the word stress. So in this orange, when we have too much stress, these are situations where it's not exactly like life-threatening or traumatic events, but they're definitely events that we don't want to happen again, right? So these are events that, for example, like a car crash that we weren't expecting. That's not fatal. It's an easy, maybe a fender bender, but still incredibly stressful, right? Or maybe an uncomfortable argument with a colleague. That's, you know, a one-time event. But something that's really uncomfortable, exhausts us, takes a lot of our energy, very stressful. Maybe our car breaks down, right? So things like that, these uncomfortable one-time events that we don't want to happen again. They're very stressful, but after they're done, after the event is done, with rest and, you know, a little bit of self-care, our bodies can recover from it. But then when we get to the very end of this curve, this red section, that's when we lead to risks of burnout and breaking down. And so these are the really highly stressful situations that could either be a one-time really traumatic event, like an assault, you know, fatal car crash, death. These are the things that we think of when we think of the really big life-altering events that just completely overwhelm our body, lead to anxiety, panic, life-threatening situations. So it can be those kind of one-time events, but it can also be like repeated orange events, right? So repeated interactions that are incredibly, you know, either negative or toxic or harassing in the workplace or in the home, right? That when we think about instances of like domestic violence, for example, it's this repeated stressful traumatic events that wear down on the body over time. And so, like I said, when we think about how this shows up in the workplace, that can look like being exposed to traumatic events of our clients over and over and over again. So these oranges incidents over and over and over again eventually lead us to be in this red space. Or it could, even if it's not specifically the trauma of our clients, it could be kind of toxic workplace incidents like repeated berating from a supervisor or a colleague, right? Or harassment of some way. So these repeated things, it really eventually get us into this dangerous level. And so our bodies aren't designed for this level of stress. We're not designed to live in this orange or especially in this red. And so it can really make it difficult for us to function. And so without proper supports in place, both on the systemic level and on an individual level, these type of chronic high stress level situations can really lead to, like I says, burnout and breakdown. And so let's look a little bit more into some common terms that come up when we think about how this orange and red kind of negative stress shows up specifically in the workplace. So the first term is burnout. And so I think we hear this term a lot, right? This term is just like self-care. It's become a buzzword. It's become kind of popular when we think about how people are interacting with the workplace. And so when we think about burnout, it's a little bit more than just kind of surface level being tired at the end of the day or maybe being annoyed by a chatty coworker. It's a deeper kind of syndrome that has become so prevalent that the World Health Organization has even characterized it, right? And thought about ways to conceptualize what this looks like. And so they define it as a syndrome that results from chronic workplace stress that has not been successfully managed. And so I think they leave it vague because, in my opinion, because it can, when they say it has not been successfully managed, I think that can be either on a systemic level, you know, that the workplace has not managed ways to handle the stress that they're putting on its workers. And also it can be on an individual level where we haven't figured out yet how to cope with the stress that we're dealing with. And so I think that when they define it, there are kind of three major parts that they say come along with burnout or make up burnout. Excuse me. So that is feelings of energy depletion or exhaustion. So again, when we think about that curve, right, we know exhaustion was towards the end of that curve. So feeling that level of exhaustion, increased mental distance from one's job. So kind of distancing yourself. I think I've heard this term come up a lot called quiet quitting, where, you know, people are starting to take on less and less without being explicit about it, but just kind of dissociating in some ways from their job due to stress. So I think that that definitely goes hand in hand with burnout, or increased cynicism related to your job. So just feeling more and more negative towards everything about your job, maybe especially things that weren't negative or that you felt passionate about before. And then finally, reduced professional efficacy. So, you know, like we saw in the beginning with those statistics, just feeling like you're losing productivity or not able to complete as much as you could before. And so burnout can be brought on by a lot of different things that can happen in the workplace. So it could be, you know, conflict with colleagues, overload of responsibilities, perception of inequality maybe in the workplace. But it also can be due to exposure to traumatic events and traumatic stories from your clients. So some common symptoms of burnout, we can see people might be feeling jumpy or on edge, difficulty concentrating, feeling guilty that you can't complete everything that you want to complete, imagining bad things are about to happen, overall just feeling cranky or like your capacity is depleted, so you're unable to even deal with small tasks and things that you could before, or increase frustration or loss of temper. So that really, when we think about burnout and we think about exposure to lots of different toxic, traumatic things, this is kind of what we're talking about when we think of ways of feeling burned out with your job. So there's another term, another phenomenon that can happen to us in the workplace. And I've often seen these terms used interchangeably, and they're really similar. But I think it's important to recognize the distinction, especially when we're thinking about what we are experiencing and ways to get help. So vicarious trauma is defined as a state experienced by those helping people or animals in distress. It's an extreme state of tension and preoccupation with the suffering of those being helped to the degree that it can create a secondary traumatic stress for the helper. So, you know, burnout can be a little bit about the trauma that your clients are bringing, but vicarious trauma is all about experiencing and witnessing the trauma of others. So vicarious trauma is less about factors like high caseload or, you know, case notes or other things that's, you know, more correlated with burnout. But vicarious trauma is really just being a witness to the trauma, the grief, the horror that other people are experiencing and that's going on in your clients' lives. And eventually it kind of shaping the way that you view the world. So much so that you start to have symptoms of the trauma of your clients as if you had experienced it firsthand. So it also is known as secondary trauma. That's kind of another term used to describe vicarious trauma. And, you know, like I said, this, when we're constantly inundated with stories of trauma, of, you know, traumatic events, it can evolve kind of into a preoccupation with it. And we become, as helpers, we become preoccupied with trauma. And that's kind of all we see. It shifts our worldview and it shapes how we see the world and our lens that we see others, that we experience the world in. And so we can start, because of this, we start developing PTSD-like symptoms, just as if, like I said, as if we had experienced it firsthand. And so that can look like re-experiencing, right? Maybe what the picture that the client painted for us when they told us their story, maybe we're re-experiencing it or having nightmares about it, being hypervigilant or hyper aroused, just the same way that we would if we had PTSD from witnessing something firsthand. It also can look like avoidance, right? So maybe avoiding situations that our clients had found themselves in, maybe like neighborhoods or blocks or, you know, just different things that are your clients that you associate with your client's trauma. Your brain has now taken it as your trauma, right? It's also associated with this idea of compassion fatigue, which is, you know, it goes along with vicarious trauma in that it's kind of the gradual lessening of compassion over time. So just kind of becoming desensitized to what other people are going through, which I think people often shame themselves for, because of course, you know, when that goes untreated, it can definitely have a negative impact on clients, but we want to be kind to ourselves and recognize that it's coming from a place of vicarious trauma, right? That our brain and our body can only handle witnessing and being in the front row to so much suffering before our brain has to start shutting down and dissociating. So compassion fatigue is kind of a coping mechanism to deal with that. And then certain factors put certain employees, again, this doesn't happen to everyone, right? But certain factors put employees at greater risk for developing these vicarious trauma symptoms. So that can look like having your own history of trauma, you know, before you entered the workforce or before you entered this particular role. Other factors that make your experience at the job either, you know, more burned out or not. So like if you have a really supportive work environment and really great supervisors and things that can help you process these things, of course, you're less likely to develop these negative impacts of vicarious trauma than someone who maybe has an incredibly cold or unsupportive work environment. And then, of course, just the current coping skills that you are bringing to your role and bringing in your tool belt can impact how vicarious trauma shows up. So let's explore a little bit of what, when we're experiencing these things, when we're experiencing levels of stress, no matter where they fall in the continuum, or we're experiencing burnout or vicarious trauma, let's explore what's going on in our brain and in our body. So I won't go into too much detail. I am horrible with science. I'm not a neuroscientist. I'm not a medical professional by any means, but I can give you a very brief layman's overview of what's going on in your body. So when we are exposed to something traumatic or stressful, it starts before our brain even realizes what's going on. So it starts with our senses. Our senses are picking up that somewhere in our environment, there's a threat present, right? And this has come from years and evolutionary ways of our brain and our body working together to keep us safe. So for example, it could be your eyes see that a car has stopped suddenly in front of you, right? Or your ears hear a loud argument happening in a public place that seems like it's escalating. But it doesn't even have to be in the present moment. Our senses also can pick up on kind of memory-based cues. So maybe we smell a cologne that reminds us of, you know, someone that we had a negative experience with, or we hear a song that was popular during a really stressful part of our life. So it could be, like I said, memory-based or in the present, but somehow your brain, your senses tell your brain, hey, something around us is not okay. We are in danger. And so when that happens, our senses, then they send a message to our brain that we're in danger, and our brain activates our nervous system. And so when that happens, there's hormones in our body that get released that prepare us for battle, right? And so that's when we notice things that happen in our body, like our heart rate starts to increase, or our breathing starts to get quicker, our blood pressure goes up, we might start sweating, right? We might feel like we need to punch something. We have an increase in alertness and awareness. So kind of that adrenaline rush, right? Those are all ways that your body is preparing you to battle whatever threat that your senses are telling you is there. And so this is where that term fight or flight comes from, because your body is literally preparing to either fight the threat, flee from the threat, or freeze in response to it. So all these things are getting your body ready to respond to the threat. So it's really important also to know that this process happens automatically. It's a reflex, right? So we might not even notice that our brain has picked up on something until we start noticing that we're shaking, right? Or that we're breathing fast, or that we're our body is starting to, something's going on, right? And so all of this has been trained to happen behind the scenes to prepare us to fight off whatever threat it is. And so even though this system has been, you know, fine-tuned over time, of course, there are still things that happen that are not ideal, right? And so ideally, once our body realizes, okay, there's really no threat here, that was a false alarm, the brakes on our, you know, fight or flight system are pressed and we can go back to normal. Our body goes back to its resting state. But the problem is, if we are exposed to stress really frequently and the system is going off all the time, then eventually becomes more sensitive, right? And so eventually our body starts to see threat everywhere and go off, that alarm system goes off all the time, even when there's not really a threat present. And when that happens, then it's hard for our body to pump the brakes, right? Then it's hard for our body to stop on its own. And so this can lead to a lot of negative effects because we're constantly being inundated with these stress hormones that are telling our body it's time for battle, it's time for battle. And it's not, right? There's actually nothing that is a threat to us in that moment. And so that cycle of being put in an alarm mode and not being able to turn that alarm off can that's when we see these negative effects of long-term stress. And so I won't go into each of them, but you know, when we hear about the effects of stress and how stress affects our body long-term, it's because of that. It's because of those stress hormones that get released that our body doesn't know how to either stop or that's it's releasing too much. So we see changes in our physical health. We see changes in our mood or in our behavior. So these are all ways that either workplace stress, again, that's what we're focusing on today, but these are just ways that stress shows up in our lives, impacts how we interact with the workplace and interacts with our body. So I know that was a pretty sobering first couple of 20, 30 minutes of the training, but I promise the rest of the training is a little more positively focused. And so the one of the biggest ways that we personally in our bodies can combat chronic stress is through self-care. And so when we think about self-care, again, in the beginning, we talked about, we understand the importance of it. But I think when we think about what it is, what exactly self-care is, I think when it's used in the media now, it's really been turned into kind of a commercialized version of its original form. And so when we think about self-care now, when people give us self-care baskets, they give us, you know, bubble baths and massage gift certificates and scented candles, right? And don't get me wrong, all of those are definitely in my arsenal of things that are great and important and can definitely help, but that's not all self-care is. And a lot of these practices are kind of like self-soothing practices that can help us once stress has already taken place to kind of get our body back down to normal levels, but it's not, they're not preventative, right? They're not ways to deal with kind of structural systemic ways that the workplace may be causing harm to our mental health. And so when we think about self-care, it's intentional decisions. It's intentional practices that we're doing to protect our well-being and happiness. And so I really love this quote by Audre Lorde. She's an amazing writer and activist. Yes, rest is resistance. I love that. And that really goes along with what we'll be talking about on this slide is just that, you know, so Audre Lorde said that caring for myself is not self-indulgence, it's self-preservation. That is an act of political welfare. And I really love, I didn't start getting into this quote really till I became a social worker and really getting into kind of community-based work. And I think those of you who choose to work in outreach and crisis response and field-based settings are really, truly some of the most selfless individuals I know. And so I think your natural inclination sometimes is to, not sometimes, but most times is, you know, to be enraged by the systemic oppression that you see, the hurdles that your clients are facing. And so you therefore go above and beyond to ease these situations, right? That you put your full self into the work. And so feeling that empathy for them and understanding their situation can sometimes cause people to then feel guilty for prioritizing themselves, right? Especially when we think about We might recognize levels of privilege or factors, power dynamics at play. And so we feel like, well, I have to put myself on the back burner, right? I have to be last. My clients have to be first. And so we then ignore our needs, right? Or we throw ourselves deeper into the work because there's so much to be done. There's so much to be done in this fight for our clients. But I really want to give you permission that both can be true. You can have healthy boundaries in place to support your clients in all of the ways that you can to the best of your ability and still preserve yourself and care for yourself. And I think sometimes this is a misconception that I know I had when I first got into the work, and I think it's a common one that I see, that self-care is a luxury afforded to workers and maybe lower needs clients, right? Or people in private practice who maybe have more time in their schedule, they have time for self-care, right? Not us, not people who have packed schedules who need to get to A, B, and C, in one day. That I don't have the time or the luxury for self-care. But I really want to push the fact that self-care really has roots in community-based work, right? It's not something that was created because people had the time or the luxury for self-care. It existed in the early 1900s, but it really gained popularity kind of in the 60s when we think about radical self-care. And during these movements, like the civil rights movement and the feminist movement, just at times where oppressed groups saw that their civil liberties or quality of life wasn't being cared for by people who held social and political power, right? So they had no choice but to care for themselves. They had to for their survival. And in order to fight for their community, in order to continue to care for their community, they had to care for themselves or else the work wouldn't get done. So self-care was really, really popularized, and radical self-care came as a result of systemic oppression. And so I want to encourage you to, that self-care can align with your goals and with your values as an outreach worker. Because by sustaining yourself to fight another day for your clients and pushing forward the agenda and why you got into this work, you have to care for and sustain yourself. So I really, really want to encourage you to take it seriously. And like I said, we will go into how it's a little bit deeper than just kind of massages and bath bombs. But the talk about some systemic ways that you can be caring for yourself while doing this work. All right, so we are going to watch a video. I love this TED Talk. It's by someone named Jifa Fanu. She's a clinical psychologist and an activist in London. And she really specializes in supporting frontline workers and just kind of challenging burnout culture in institutional and community-based settings. And then, so check out this video.
Helping people tell their stories is at the core of what I do as a psychologist. Today, I'm going to start by telling you a story. Adam was the type of person that people found really easy to talk to. He was that guy in school who knew instinctively how to be empathetic and support people in need. He naturally followed a pathway into a helping profession and trained to be a mental health social worker. In his first week on the ward, he was all full of energy. He was excited. He couldn't wait to use his skills in connecting with people. Adam was the one who sat for hours with Femi when he first arrived on the ward, scared and confused. It was Adam's kind presence and big smile that helped Femi feel seen and cared for. Weeks into the job, and Adam starts to notice the traits of his colleagues. His manager never takes time off and always works long hours. Although she tells Adam to go home on time, her behavior gives the message that to succeed, he needs to be willing to give more of himself to the work. His colleagues never take lunch and are always complaining about how overworked they are. And he's saddened as he...
Oh, so sorry about that.
...seen and cared for. Weeks into the job, and Adam starts... His colleagues never take lunch and are always complaining about how overworked they are. And he's saddened as he sees many of them working from a place of disconnection and the insensitive ways that they talk about and treat the people on the ward. He worries that one day he may have to become so disconnected himself. Time goes on and he's starting to feel the pressure. He's getting less sleep, constantly rushing from appointment to appointment, never feeling that he has enough time to exercise the very skills that got him into the work. It starts to have an impact on him. He's taking time off work for ill health and chronic stress, and eventually, he feels he has to leave his job. Stories like Edem, they may be familiar to many of you. In fact, they've become so familiar that in many lines of work, they're expected. I recognize much of my own experience in Edem's story. In fact, in the early stages of my career, I also found myself in an inpatient ward. Often, I'd return to my office in tears. I was deeply affected by the ways that I saw my colleagues working from a place of disconnection. Many of the people on the ward had had extreme life circumstances or had experienced childhood trauma, and it hurt to see how they were cruelly they were talked about and treated. I spent the last 10 years of my career asking myself the question, why? Why do good people who can be so humane to each other and to their families end up treating people who are vulnerable as if they are products rather than people? I've come to the belief that one of the many reasons are due to the things that cause and maintain burnout culture. There are decades of studies of so-called burnout, but what so many of these studies do is individualize the issue of burnout. They make it into a phenomena that happens to one match at a time, and the solutions are focused at one individual at a time. There's this idea that all we have to do is get workers to look after themselves, be more boundaried, you know, just don't work so hard. But you can't solve this issue one individual at a time. It's like putting out a single match when really you're standing in a forest fire. This culture is in all of our frontline services, and it's going to take all of us to change it. Social workers like Edem are likely to burn out within 8 years. 91% of social workers report high to moderate levels of emotional exhaustion. And these statistics focus on social work, but the same could be said in many other forms of work with marginalized people. In my profession, psychology, for example, in medicine, care work, activism, community work, teaching, the list goes on. Many of these issues are central to our understanding of what it means to help. There's this unwritten understanding that it's just a part of the job. There's this idea that those who give support are full cups and need to empty all of their resource into the empty cups of the needy. It's an old model of care that has some of its roots in charity and colonial missionary work. In those models, there were those who went to help the needy. They went from a place of moral superiority, and they had an urgent and righteous mission to change the circumstances of those that were seen as less than. In our modern iteration of these models, people can work tirelessly for those in need. And not only is this model unsustainable, it's a model that both harms those who are expected to give unending resource and those who are dehumanized in the assumption that they're empty of resource. Our tendency to ignore our own needs, it shows up in many other areas of our lives. It actually makes me think about the profound messaging on the standard safety procedure of a flight. We often miss it, distracted by our fear or excitement about the flight ahead. But it's a deeply profound idea that in the event of emergency, we need to make sure that we put on our own oxygen mask first before putting anybody else's on. It says something about an element of human nature that we sometimes forget ourselves when faced with somebody in need. When I hear these safety announcements, I think to myself, yeah, it makes sense. But I can't say how easy I would find it flying with my daughter and faced with an emergency situation. I hope that I'll remember to put on my own mask, that by putting my mask on, I can more likely ensure both of our lives. Our images of the heroic form around the idea of people who sacrifice their needs for the good of another. We use the terminology of frontline worker. It comes from military language, and it's like we have this expectation that workers are in combat and need to be willing to put their lives on the line for others. Of course, there are those who don't try to avoid burnout, basically, and they ignore how they feel and they disconnect from the work. You know, it's just a job after all. But I believe that this disconnection harms. Even the most dedicated and empathetic practitioner may find at times that they need to approach their work from a more objective and distant position, often working with people who are full of emotion and pain. We feel like we have to be a bit more distant from them. Sometimes we're exhausted and we feel like we need to disconnect from our bodies. Sometimes we just don't feel like we have the resource to be deeply present with the people that we're working with. But I believe that this disconnection harms everyone involved. It's from this disconnection that it becomes easier for us to dehumanize each other. Some of what I'm saying, it might be hard to hear. There may be some of you who are saying, well, yeah, but not me, not my job, not my work, I can't. I get it. I've had those conversations myself. No one of us is the source of the problem. And no one has got all the answers. But I do believe if we're ever going to change burnout culture, we need to be willing to fully confront it. I'm not saying there's never any place for heroics in the form of sacrifice for the needs of another. But the difference is that for many frontline workers, those sacrifices are constant. It's not just about jumping in front of a bus that one time to save somebody. People can get stuck working longer hours every day, constantly working even when they're unwell themselves. This form of heroic that is chronic and inflexible, it's deadly for the hero. We've seen in the COVID pandemic the terrible consequences of the failure to provide protective equipment for those who work to save the lives of so many. Even when faced with urgent situations, people are not supported and given the structures that they need. Many of the health professions and allied services were already overstretched and heavily impacted by burnout culture. In COVID, we see such an example of how our models of care fail to take care of the people that care. And the consequences, they're terrible for all of us. We've also seen in COVID an example of just how interconnected we are. When one person in the world becomes sick, we're all affected. Any gaps in our public health services can have tragic global effects. Returning to Edem's story. Some of you while listening to his story might imagine that the reason he became so exhausted and eventually had to leave his job was due to the behaviors of his colleagues and his manager, but it's not really about them. It's about an institutional system that runs from a model of deficit. For example, Femi. Edem supported his discharge out of the hospital, but he went home to an unstable housing situation. He became homeless, which increased the likelihood that he's likely to be admitted to hospital again. It's these multiple systems that fail to meet the basic needs of the people that we work with. Not enough housing and few forms of employment that are really responsive to those with mental health needs. For me, the problem has never really been the people I work with or the pain they've been in. For me, it's been witnessing the marginalization, inequality, and oppression on the lives of so many. I've been exhausted by that feeling that I'm trying to fill a bucket-sized cup with a teaspoon while other systems keep punching holes in the bottom. So what do we do about it? There's no easy, neat, step-by-step answers to how we resolve this issue. But one of the ways that we can all change is by altering our perception of what it means to give help. We need to deeply dissolve the boundary between those who help and those who are helped. One of the best kept secrets about my job is that actually, it's a give and take relationship. It's not that you get the satisfaction of helping people in need. I've learned so much from the many people I've had the pleasure of working with. Their wisdom, bravery, and inventiveness have taught me so much about human nature. About my own nature. I've learned about other knowledge systems that medicine, science, and psychology don't have all the answers. And each of the people I've worked with has an expertise of experience and skills and knowledge that are as deep and as significant as my own. We need to acknowledge that the boundary between helper and helped is actually fluid and temporary. I've seen just how fluid and temporary that boundary can be in my own life. Moving from the position of supporter to someone who needed support. Through extreme fatigue and chronic pain, I had to find the grace to ask for help and receive it. I had to learn that my worth was more than what I could do. And I was fortunate. I saw my intrinsic worth mirrored back to me by the community around me. My experience of disability, illness, and health have given me a deep insight into one of the fundamental truths: that human beings are a profoundly interdependent species. We need each other. No cup is full and no cup is empty. One of the core messages of this talk has been about disconnection and how it can harm the people that we work with. I believe we really need to look at disconnection, and to address it, we need to be willing to be vulnerable. We need to be willing to ask ourselves difficult questions. We need to be willing to give ourselves honest answers. Why do we disconnect? Why do we ignore our own needs? And how can we be more present? We really need to start reimagining what it means to be a hero. Heroes ask for help when they need it. Heroes fight for more just systems that fully resource those who need support. Heroes take time off. Heroes prioritize rest, healing, and resourcing themselves. Heroes don't have to strive alone, but are surrounded by communities that value them and the work they do. There are heroics in both giving and receiving care. In our moments of need, of vulnerability, it takes courage to truly receive care. We all need that courage if we're ever going to imagine that anything else is possible, and to truly reimagine what it means to give and receive health and care.
So I always find that video really empowering, and just there's a lot of gems and a lot of quotes that I love to take from that video. But I'd love to hear your thoughts, either unmute or in the chat, just some ideas that stuck out for you from that video, things she brought up that resonated with you. I'd love to hear what you think. I think one of the things that she said is there's courage in giving and receiving care, right? That we're not the hero if just because we give, right? We have to be able to receive and take care of ourselves. And that's what makes us helpers. So I completely agree with you. I'm glad that resonated for you. We have a lot of great points in the chat too. So it's okay to ask for help for ourselves. I really like how she connected her experience of chronic pain to reaching out. Yep. And understanding the interdependence, but like disabled ways of being and connecting with others can really help in our understanding of self-care and community care. Disability justice has really ground me in my learning on how to sustainably care for myself. Yeah, that's amazing. So true. I think, and I think it's unfortunate that sometimes it takes our bodies to experience something like chronic pain or illness or, you know, whatever it is, for us to be able to get into the mentality of knowing how important it is to care for ourselves and in order to care for community. So yeah, I was glad that she brought that up as well. It's okay to say no in order to prioritize yourself and personal self-care. I completely agree. I think, to me, one of the biggest systemic ways that you can implement self-care is saying no. This is, you know, it's not in my capacity to do that. I can't do this, but here's what I can offer you. That when I find myself becoming really burnt out, that becomes my favorite go-to thing. I can't do that, but here's what I can do for you. Because saying no is really such a powerful way to care for yourself. And it's hard in our settings. That we are there to care for others, but when those are expressing empathy and sympathy for us, then it's time to take care of ourselves. 100%. It's nice to hear others feel the way I do. Good. Yeah, this is a chance for you to learn things, but also, again, hopefully that validation that you are absolutely not alone. And the numbers show that you're not alone, right? And it's true. I think some of the best ways we can advocate for ourselves, and it's unfortunate that sometimes our word alone may not do it, but a doctor's note or word can go incredibly far in terms of being able to advocate for accommodations or support that you might need. And I think that there's, again, no shame in that, but sometimes it takes that speaking to what's going on in your body in order to advocate for what you need. So I think that's a really, really great point, and a great tool to use as well. Thank you so much for bringing that up. It's so true. And I think what you speak to just about the words that we speak to other people, we start to internalize, right? So if we're constantly apologizing, then our brain thinks that we're the burden, we're the problem. You know, we can't make mistakes. We can't be we have to be perfect, right? And so I love that way of reframing. And you know, if I'm not sorry, I'm not going to apologize because I didn't do anything wrong. And so I think that language piece is so important, and just reframing from, instead of I'm sorry, you know, I appreciate your patience, right? Those little ways of framing things can make such a difference. So I really, really, really appreciate you bringing that up. Thank you. So yeah, we have, again, just some great points in the chat too, of setting boundaries, streamlining some systems for folks has been something that's really helpful. Seeing yourself in community with your clients. Again, I think that speaks to what Jiffa brought up in the video too, of that line between helper, the bigger that gap is between helper and helped, that kind of patronizing way sometimes of looking at clients can increase your burnout, right? Because if you're seeing your clients as you're a filled cup and they're an empty cup and you have to pour all of yourself into them, right? That's incredibly a patronizing way to look at a client, but really makes it seem like they don't have their own strengths and we have to do all the work, when in fact, you know, they come with their own sense of community and strength. Is a great way to help us to feel more connected to clients and less burnt out. So unfortunately, I have to move to the next slide. I would love to kind of stay in this conversation. I think we could have a 2-hour training just on this alone. So I'm glad that the video resonated with you all, and I appreciate your feedback on it and just your thoughts of it. So again, you'll have access to this slide and this video, so feel free to watch it at your leisure. And it's really a great video, and she has if you look up their name, they have other videos as well online, and just the work that they're doing is great. So I encourage you to check that out. So when we start to think about ways to build a self-care plan for ourselves, one theory I like to look at, or I like to consult, is Maslow's hierarchy of needs. So Abraham Maslow, he was a psychologist who theorized that humans are motivated by needs that kind of grow in complexity from more basic to abstract. And he argued that the needs need to be met in order. And then once they're all met in order, then humans can truly be fulfilled. And so this theory is about 80 years old, you know, so of course it hasn't gone without some changes over the years and, you know, criticism. So I don't get too caught up in the logistics of everything needs to be met in order for you to feel like a complete human being. We obviously have really complex needs. And so I just look kind of, I like to consult kind of the fundamental idea behind it, right? That we as humans all have complex needs, and it's really hard to meet them all at once. And so what can be helpful for us is to prioritize our most basic needs first, and then have that frees us up to then meet the rest of our needs. And I think when we're coming up with a plan or a strategy, especially a preventative strategy to care for ourselves, that idea of prioritizing needs to eventually get to the kind of higher level abstract needs can be really helpful. So we're not feeling so overwhelmed. We're not feeling like we have to tackle everything all at once. So just to kind of go through it, because these kind of broader categories will guide how we talk about strategies today. So at the bottom, we have these basic needs. So this is food, water, warmth, rest. These are things our body physically needs in order to survive, right? And in that same vein, basic needs, we need the need for security and safety, right? So these basic needs are a thing before we can think about anything else. We have to eat, we have to rest, we have to be safe, right? Those are things that have to be cared for first before anything else. And then as we move up the triangle, we have our psychological needs. So this is the need for belongingness and love, right? So that's social support, intimacy, friends, esteem needs, right? The need to feel like we're accomplishing something, that we're doing a good job. And I think we definitely see this coming up in the workforce, right? And then finally, at the very top, self-fulfillment needs. So being able to achieve your full potential, feeling like you're aligned with your values. This is a lot of times where spirituality comes into play too. just feeling aligned and aware and fulfilled with where you are in life. But again, it's very hard to think about your values as a person, and how they align with your job, and is that aligned with my ultimate professional goals if I'm starving, right? So it's important to kind of think about the, making sure that we're prioritizing needs so that we can eventually get to all of them and treating ourselves holistically. So this will kind of frame how we talk about our self-care plan today. So what I first want to do is, as we get into talking about our self-care plan, I want to first talk about reactionary self-care. So I want you to think back to about 20 minutes ago when we reviewed the stress response system. And so we learned that in the moment, once we are already experiencing stress, we're already escalated, we're already heightened, there are things that happen in our body. And ideally, this system turns off by itself, but sometimes it doesn't, right? And so when we're chronically stressed, when we're exhausted, when we're burnt out, this system often doesn't turn off by itself. And so we have to do things to put the brakes on this system. So here are some strategies that we can use in the moment. These aren't preventative, right? These aren't things that we put into place as part of our action plan for long term. This is in the moment. I am escalated. I'm stressed. I am tired. What are some things I can do to tell my body, okay, the threat is gone. Please go back to normal. So the first one is relaxation techniques. These are things that you can do to manually pump the brakes on the stress response system in your body. The first one of that is deep breathing. So, and again, I know it's so cliche. People say just take a couple deep breaths and you'll be fine, right? It's a little more nuanced than that, right? But really scientifically, when we exhale, it sends a message to our brain to pump the brakes on that stress response system. So there is truth in people telling you take a couple deep breaths, but it's not just one or two, right? So it's really having the space to have structured deep breaths for at least a few minutes, like five or more, and ideally in through your nose and out through your mouth. And the kind of deep breathing should you should feel your abdomen going in and out, not your chest. So it shouldn't be shoulders moving up, not that kind of chest breathing. That doesn't send the message to your body to calm down. It's slow. When I used to work with children, we would call them belly breaths. So literally putting your hands on your stomach to be able to feel your abdomen going in and out, breathing in through your nose and out through your mouth. That kind of deep breathing is going to send a message to your body that you are safe, the threat is gone, and it can kind of manually turn off those brakes, or turn on the brakes, excuse me. So there are lots of breathing, there are lots of different ways you can structure this kind of breathing. You can look on YouTube. There's a plethora of videos that show these kind of techniques. There are things like box breathing, where you imagine you're breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out. That's the kind of exercise you can do. There are exercises called butterfly breathing, where you're kind of tapping yourself to deep breathe. That can be really powerful. There are things called 4-7-8 breathing, where you breathe in for a certain amount of seconds, you hold, and then you breathe out. There are a million ways to do it. None of them are the right or wrong way. So whatever works for you, but as long as you are engaging in deep breathing, that can be a great way to relax your body. The next one is called positive visualization. So again, remember when we think back to that stress response system, we know that our senses are incredibly powerful in telling our body, hey, there's a threat. So we can also use those senses to say, hey, we're in a safe, relaxing space. Our body can calm down now. So with positive visualization, this is a technique where you close your eyes, of course, when you're safe to do so, and you imagine yourself in another setting that feels safe and calming to you. So it could be anything. It could be, I think the most popular one is, relaxing on a beach somewhere. But it can also just be, your bed or your childhood home or maybe at your grandma's kitchen, right? Any space that feels safe to you. It could be anywhere in the world, and it can be a real place or it can be a made-up place. It doesn't matter. The most important part about this technique is that you think about it in as much detail as possible, so you start to trick your senses into thinking that you're there. So, for example, if your safe space is sitting at your grandma's kitchen, right? Then what are you smelling? What is she cooking? What kind of music is playing on the radio? What kind of sounds do you hear? Right? So, all engaging all of your senses. in that activity so that your body starts to eventually think that you're safe and calm down. Again, YouTube is an amazing support for this. They have guided videos. They have some like in a forest, on a beach. So if you need help with that, there are tons of videos for positive visualization, but that one is a really great one. The next one is repetitive mantra-based practices. So this can look like meditation, or just sessions where you're repeating words to your words or short phrases to yourself over and over and over again. So I think sometimes people naturally do this when they're really upset, right? They might say, "It's okay, it's okay, it's okay." Or you can say things like, "I am calm, I am safe," right? Just repeating that to yourself over and over and over again. Prayer would also fit under this category if that's something that you personally have in your toolkit or something that you personally use, but that repetition is the most important part. That repetition really helps to send a message to our body to calm down. Funny enough, coloring also is why coloring is so powerful for children. That repetition, that repetitive movement back and forth, repetition can really send messages to our body that we're calm and safe. So that one is a really powerful one as well, along with, like I said, coloring also can kind of fit in that movement. The next way we can calm our body down or put on those brakes is physical movement. So again, this is when our bodies are super stressed out. I'm not talking about doing, a HIIT exercise or a CrossFit. It's gentle exercises like taking a walk while you're stressed. Things like yoga and Tai Chi are ones that are really popular for releasing stress in your body because they combine focusing on your breath with also kind of fluid movements and mental focus. So those all can kind of induce sense of calmness. So those are all really important ones. And then finally, relationships, social support is a way that we can stop and put the brakes on that stress response system in the moment. Our nervous system really loves to feel empathy and to feel like someone sees us and is there for us. And so in the moment, I think that's the importance of having that community at work, because it's great if you can kind of call someone on the phone or when you get home, you have someone to speak to. But it's really important in the moment that you have someone who understands, who does similar work, right? So having that work friend, having that accountability partner, can be really helpful in the moment when your stress response system is heightened and alert and you need someone to help you calm down. So again, these are ones when we're already experiencing stress in the moment, we feel ourselves getting escalated, whether that's, increased heart rate, feeling just lots of adrenaline in our body. These are all things that you can do in the moment. So now what we'll talk about is preventative self-care, things that you can plan to do and just make part of your daily, weekly, monthly practice so that you can start preventing yourself from getting there, preventing yourself from getting to that stressful, burnt out stage. I want to warn you that over these next slides, I'm going to be showing you a bunch of different strategies. I like to compare it to kind of like a Cheesecake Factory menu of strategies. When if you've been to the Cheesecake Factory, you know that that menu can be a little overwhelming, right? There's a million pages, and you're not expected to order everything at once, right? So I want you to treat these slides in the same fashion that you do not have to try every single one. Not everything will work for everyone, right? What strategy might work for one organization or for one person might not jive with, what someone else needs in their organization. So I want you to see this just as a menu and you can pick and choose what might work for you. And some might work in different settings at different times. But I want to just give that disclaimer. Okay. So again, like I said, we'll be kind of thinking about this in terms of that triangle. So we'll be starting off with things that you can do to meet your basic needs first, then we'll kind of go higher up that triangle to then our mental health needs, our psychological needs, and then finally at the top of that triangle for our kind of fulfillment and ultimate values needs. Okay, so these are the ways, just different strategies that you can use. And again, I want to reiterate, these are a lot of these things might be things you're already doing to care for your basic needs in the field. So when we think about food, right? So when you're in the field, bringing water with you, always having water with you in mind and energy friendly snacks. So things that you know aren't going to lead to a huge sugar crash in the afternoon, or snacks that you know aren't going to affect your mood later on when you have a difficult client or when you have a big meeting that you need that energy for, or that you want to make sure you don't have low blood sugar for, right? So snacks that sustain your mood. So being intentional about what you're eating, and because you know how they impact your ability to do the work. Scheduling mealtimes in advance when possible. I know me personally, if I say that I'll grab food along the way or I'll figure it out, I'll grab lunch in between clients, it won't happen, right? I have to set a time or a landmark, to help you prioritize. And this doesn't mean you have to do full meal prep all the time. I know I don't have the organization for that. So people who are able to do that, I respect you so much and really have so much respect for you. So it doesn't necessarily mean you have to do that. It just means planning out what you're going to do in advance. So for example, if you know you have you're going to be on, Manchester and Broadway, I'm going to go to that subway then in between my 1 o'clock and my 3 o'clock. Or I'm going to do my progress notes at Starbucks on Sunset after my 2 o'clock before I go back to the office so that I can have a snack. It's just kind of thinking through your route for the day and what are some stops along the way, around what time am I going to be there? Okay, I'm going to grab something over there. That way you already know and kind of have it in your agenda before you go out into the field. That can be really powerful. The next one is physical comfort. So mapping out bathrooms in advance, right? You never want to be in a situation where you have to use the restroom, especially because I'm encouraging you to drink water, right? And you don't know where the restrooms are. So just mapping those out in advance. Again, these are things that I know you're already doing. So comfortable, weather appropriate clothing, accessories, footwear. If your feet hurt or if you're cold or if you're too hot, then you're much more likely to be irritable with clients. You're much more likely to then bring that energy and feel like at the end of the day you had a bad day. Then that contributes to burnout, right? And so making sure that those physical needs are being met. This one is really important. Something in, excuse me, I feel like I didn't start doing until much later in my career. Regularly checking in on your mood and energy, and if you're able to, shifting your duties or your expectations for yourself accordingly. So this might be easier or harder depending on your role or your organization, but you should start being in the practice of regularly just taking a pulse on how you're doing. How's my energy and my mood today? And if you have flexibility in your schedule, then maybe you save your more demanding cases or conversations for when your mood or energy is higher, right? If I know that I always have this spike of energy at 2 o'clock, after my lunch is digested, then I'm going to put my client that involves or that requires the most energy, I'm going to put them at that time, right? Because then I know that I'll have the capacity for them. I'm not going to put them at 8 a.m. when I know that I can't do it. And so I'm walking away then feeling guilty because we had a negative conversation and now my capacity is lower, right? So being really strategic about where you know your body and your mood is. And so I know that definitely not a possibility for everyone, right? Sometimes you don't have that flexibility. So in those situations, then continuing to check in with yourself, but giving yourself grace, right? I know that my energy, I'm coming in at a 2 right now. I wish I were at a 5, but I'm at a 2. So I'm going to monitor or I'm going to alter my expectations for this session for today. As long as I, have a positive attitude, then it's okay if I don't meet X, Y, and Z, right? So just kind of checking in with where you are. And altering either your expectations or your tasks accordingly. Physical health. So just making sure you're bringing any necessary medications with you on the field, setting timers or alarms to remind yourself to take your medication when you're out in the field. Again, just like food, I know sometimes we say, well, I'll remember to take my medicine while I'm out in the field. And then a crisis happens and you don't remember, right? And now you've gone a long time without your medication. So just setting those timers, bringing them with you, tending to regular checkups, screening, and doctor's appointments, right? I know that when we are experiencing high levels of stress, sometimes these preventative things go out the window, right? These preventative screenings, these preventative appointments, they go out the window and we keep putting it off until our body is in crisis, right? And so not waiting until it gets to that point, having these regularly scheduled meetings so that you're not getting to a crisis point in your body. So continuing with basic needs, the need for safety and security again is part of that basic need. So things that you can do to care for yourself when you're out in the field, teamwork, collaboration, and communication. So always letting someone know where you are, either directly or through maybe like a shared calendar, if possible, going to locations with a team or with a partner. Noting client or neighborhood safety issues that might be a concern for you. So this may like this sometimes this involves pre-work, right? So looking at a client file or talking to another worker who's familiar with that area so that you can just be aware of anything that you should know ahead of time, where to park, right? Safety concerns, anything like that. Again, personal safety strategies that I know you already get when you onboard in your role. But just things, you know, keeping your head on a swivel, being aware of your surroundings, all things to kind of protect yourself, but keep you feeling more confident and safe when you're in the field. And then, like I said, planning in advance. So mapping out your location ahead of time, or driving there ahead of time if you've never been there before can really help that sense of confidence before meeting with a client. Also helps you not look lost when you arrive, right? So that you're seen as more confident in your role and in your abilities. Having a loose agenda in your head ahead of time before you're meeting with a client, knowing where you have reception and where you don't ahead of time. That way, again, you're always putting yourself in a position where you feel in control of your surroundings and your well-being. In the office, ways that you can care for your need for safety and security. And I think someone, you know, a few folks have already spoken to this, which is great, but speaking up, right? Your supervisors and colleagues, they can't read your mind. And so I think one thing that we realize too is that everyone has a different threshold for how they perceive safety, and security based on their experiences, where they're from, where they live, what they look like. So what might feel like a safe or not potentially threatening situation to a veteran, right? Someone who's been in the field, someone who has been in that particular role for maybe 10, 15 years can feel very different than someone who is new to the city, right? Or new to the role or fresh out of grad school or, you know, whatever the case is. And so if you're feeling unsafe or uncomfortable for whatever reason, whether that's with a colleague, you know, colleague to colleague interaction or with a client, or with a neighborhood assignment perhaps that you have, it's really important, and if you feel safe to do so with the relationship that you have with your supervisor, to speak up about it. And I think that this can be helpful in for two reasons. The first is so that you can brainstorm, you know, strategies and accommodations together that can help you. But I think then the second reason why this can be helpful is because it can also point out any biases that are coming up for you. If there may be blind spots or some biases that you might have about a neighborhood or a client, speaking up about how you feel can help, you know, develop your awareness in that way. And so speaking up about your discomfort can really help you to be able to develop, a self-care plan for yourself, but also you as a provider. So those are kind of the basic needs. Oh, I'm sorry. There's one more I wanted to review on this slide. Knowing your policies around safety, crisis management, reporting. I know sometimes those beginning of the year or beginning of your role automated trainings can be kind of redundant or you know, they're not always the most engaging. But they can be really helpful in terms of planning for your safety. And again, all of this is preventative so that when something happens in the moment, you feel prepared to handle it. So making sure that you're up to date with those, attending regularly scheduled or necessary safety related trainings. And then safety and security also includes your job or financial security. So just making sure that you are taking the actions to understand your role, your benefits, your title, and advocating for things that you might need in order to feel secure within that realm as well. So not just your physical safety and security, but financial security also is definitely part of your basic needs as a human and you know, especially living in Los Angeles. So making sure that you're caring for that part of your well-being. So once we move past the kind of basic needs, we move more into the psychological needs and self-care. And I think sometimes when we think about self-care, these are some of the more popular strategies that we think of ways to care for our mental health. But again, it's hard to do that if we're hungry or if we're tired or if we're sick, right? So that's why it's important to care for those basic needs first, so that we then have the freedom and the capacity to worry about this. So when we think about emotional health, again, I think that most people who engage in this kind of work could always benefit from having someone to talk through and talk through the things that they hear about and the things that their clients experience that we're being inundated with. So if you need to access therapy or your employee assistance program, that's something that can be really, really beneficial. And I think this is especially true for people who are experiencing vicarious trauma or those PTSD-like symptoms, because oftentimes those are things that don't just go away on their own. That's not something that if I, you know, just kind of get some rest and maybe I take a day off or something, those kind of physical symptoms that are showing up in your body, like PTSD, those are things that you need to talk through with a professional. So especially if you're experiencing vicarious trauma, anything like that, definitely therapy or any kind of emotional support in that way is going to be really helpful. Crisis debriefing is a strategy that is, I encourage organizations to use. And if your organization doesn't currently do it, you can always do this with a colleague on your own or advocate for it to be more system-wide. But what this is after heavy work-related crises. So for example, you know, you have to restrain a client, or a client dies, or you have to hospitalize a client, you know, these kind of heavy things that happen in the workplace. Studies show that taking the time before the end of the day to discuss it, so not 2 weeks later, not on your next shift, ideally as soon as possible by the end of the day, when you debrief with the people, other people impacted by it, so maybe anyone else who works with that client, anyone else who's involved, when you debrief together, talk about how this situation made you feel, things you want to change for next time, your action plan moving forward, this can really help decrease that burnout or vicarious trauma that can happen as a result of that incident. So crisis debriefing is always, always really helpful. Mind clearing. This is something where you have some kind of ritual at the end of the day to kind of close out your workday. So for some people, that could be meditation. For some people, it could be going to the gym directly after work. For some people, it could be something as simple as when I used to work at a school, it was when I took my lanyard off. That was my personal way of telling my brain I needed to switch off social worker mode and now enter my personal mode, right? So some kind of end of day ritual. Like I said, it could be something as simple as taking off your lanyard very mindfully, or meditating, going to a exercise class, whatever it is, something to signal to your brain, I'm turning this off. Now we are going to enter in my personal mode. A little bit harder if you're on call or someone who works maybe 24/7. So things that you can do, or if you work from home. So things that you can do for that is just, again, doing your work maybe in different space than, like, you know, not doing work on your bed, because then your brain won't be able to tell the difference. But having a designated space at home where you're doing your work, working at a coffee shop, changing your clothes when you're done for the day to signal to your brain, okay, we're out of work mode and now in home mode. Little things like that can signal to your brain that I no longer need to have this part of my brain working right now. So something to kind of close out your day. Radical acceptance is a concept that comes from DBT, and we won't go, you know, too deeply into it, but it's really just the idea of letting go of that we have the illusion of control of everything, right? And just being willing to accept and notice things as they are right now without judgment. And I think this can really be helpful, especially in situations where we feel helpless or wish that our clients would make a different choice, wish that our organization was different, but maybe right now we don't have the power to change that. Radical acceptance really helps us with that distress tolerance and handling it better. So we have a really great training on that. I link it in the end of our slides. I have some links to different trainings. So I definitely encourage you to check that out if you want a little bit more information about that. Same thing with self-compassion. It's another powerful tool that we can use as practitioners. And it's really similar in that we're just being present with our suffering and with our shortcomings in a non-judgmental way. And we treat ourselves with the same kindness that we would treat our clients. So again, this theme of we are just as deserving of care as our clients are. And it can really shift how we talk to ourselves and how we criticize ourselves in our brain. So again, speaking to what we were talking about earlier, where that shift in how we're internalizing ourselves as a burden or judging ourselves or criticizing ourselves, that can cause us so much more burnout. And so changing how we speak to ourselves in our mind. Again, that one is also on our website as well. When we think about our psychological needs, social needs are also a really big part of that. So building community in healthy ways with colleagues or maybe like-minded people who share a same hobby or part of the same community as you or do similar work to you, just really having that sense of community, no matter what it's based on, geographic or interest-wise. Having an accountability partner who understands what you're going through day to day can really help. Professional esteem and appreciation. So these are practices that infuse joy in the workplace and really make people feel appreciated. So things like having, in my previous experiences, these committees were called like a sunshine committee or a love committee. It can be called whatever you want. It doesn't even need to have a name, but it's just a group of people who are the spirit of the workplace, right? So these are the people who decorate for people's birthdays. These are the ones who throw the baby showers or the wedding showers or happy hours, or they plan the holiday celebrations, whatever it is. These are people whose it's their task, it's their role to think about how to infuse joy and things to look forward to and celebrating people in the workplace. So these sometimes they happen naturally. There's just kind of some festive people who naturally tend to have these roles. Sometimes it's a little more structured, and so I think that having it structured and having it an identified group of people can be really helpful to make sure things don't fall through the cracks or so that it doesn't all fall on one person to be the spirit of the office. But those things can be really, really helpful. I found that utilizing employees' love languages. So if you don't know what your love language is, there's tests you can take online. You just look up five love languages. But finding out what your employees' love languages are. So whether that's your coworker, or if you're in a supervisory position, finding out how people like to feel appreciated. And while of course some things aren't as appropriate for the workplace, like if someone loves, like physical affection, you're not always able to do that. But if someone really loves gifts or words, then you know that people, for that person, you can give them a gift card to show your appreciation, or you can write them a card if they like words of affirmation, or if they like to be publicly acknowledged or privately acknowledged for their good work. So just finding out how people like to be appreciated can really go a long way in spreading that joy in the workplace. And then writing down compliments and victories and gains that you have. If you keep a little notebook or put it on stickies on your desk or on your desktop of your computer, sometimes you need that to get you through when you are feeling low, when you're feeling like, oh, what did I accomplish today? Or am I doing good work? What am I doing here? Remembering the compliments that you get, especially from clients, right? Those oftentimes go so far, but writing down compliments that you get, writing down accomplishments, writing down those victories. So in those moments when you're having a tough time remembering them, you can go back and read them and give yourself a little boost. And then finally, when we get to that top of the triangle, right? So we've met our basic needs, we're caring for our mental health. The very top of that triangle is the need to just be self-aware, fulfilled, connected to a greater purpose. So these are kind of some reflection practices that you can do to support your ability to stay in the field, right? The ultimate purpose of these kind of strategies is to keep you in the field, to keep your fire going, to keep your why going of why you got into outreach work in the first place. So again, whatever you need to do to remind yourself of your why, that could be, if it's a specific cause, whether it's something visual that you need, like stickers on your dashboard or sticky notes on your dashboard or on your desk or your workspace, or a particular picture of a client or a family member that reminds you of why you got into this work. Those visual cues can help you feel really connected. Again, if you're someone who has, if you're feeling connected to spiritual or religious beliefs, this is where that comes in as well, helping you stay connected to your ultimate purpose or your why. Another one that can be really helpful to keep your self-fulfillment going in the field is looking beyond just client outcomes to measure your success. And so there's a really great book about practitioner well-being that I've also linked at the end. But what they say is, it's if you only look at how well your clients are doing to measure your success and your purpose in the field, you oftentimes will feel really disappointed, right? Because there's so many things that are outside of your control. And more importantly, our clients have the right to self-determination, right? So if they choose something different than you, it doesn't necessarily mean you failed. It means that they're an adult with the ability to choose something different. And so what the research suggests is looking at how you're progressing and growing in your professional knowledge. Like, are you attending trainings, which you already are because you're here, so you can check that off, right? But are you trying to grow? Are you trying to build your tools, both, tools like learning different strategies, but also just those soft tools. Like, for example, what we spoke to earlier, I'm learning to say no more. I'm learning to, not criticize myself. I'm learning to not apologize. Those are amazing ways that you're progressing and advancing in the field and a great measure of success for yourself in the field. So that's one way to measure your success. And then also, how much effort are you putting into building relationships with colleagues and clients? Is there a client that wouldn't talk to you before, wouldn't come out of their tent before, and now when you come, you're the only one that they want to talk to, right? That's huge. Even if they're not meeting some of the goals that maybe is on their treatment plan, if they're growing in their relationship with you, that's a great way to measure your success, right? So looking for other ways to get that fulfillment that you're doing a great job. Again, prioritizing learning opportunities. So it's a great way to help the job stay fresh and get you excited about things that you can try. And then really tapping into your own vision, your own mission statement. Again, we have a great training by a psychologist named Jennifer Wisdom, who talks about how to create your own mission and vision statement the same way that your agencies have, or the same ways that different organizations do. And this can help you kind of think holistically about your role. Is it aligning with what I ultimately want to do? But again, it's hard to do that when those other needs aren't met. So that's why it's important to have this kind of comprehensive way to meet all of those domains. All right. So I know that was a lot of information. That was a lot of talking for me. And so now you're going to get a few minutes. I'm going to give you 10 minutes to create your own self-care plan. And so I think a lot of you in your job, either as clinicians or outreach workers, you create safety plans for clients, right? And you think about their triggers, you think about their stressors, you come up with some strategies for them to try, and you do it when things are calm, you do it when they're a little more stable, so that when a crisis happens, you can implement this. And so you're going to think about this the same way for yourself, right? You're going to have this plan that you have quiet time to work on, so that when a crisis happens or before a crisis happens, you can refer back to this plan. So what I'm going to go through this plan really quickly. I'm going to put it in the chat for you so that you can see it. It's a PDF file, so you can either print it out and write on it, or if you have, Adobe, or I think Preview as well, you can just edit it right on the PDF and add text to it. So feel free to open it and follow along. But this will be an opportunity for you to think through a few things. The first thing you're going to think through is, what are my triggers, right? What are some things that make you stressed out and make you feel unsafe or uncomfortable or out of control? So these can be simple feelings like, I know when I'm sleepy or when I'm hungry, I get really irritable. So hunger, sleep, sleepiness, right? That can be a trigger. Or it can be the actions of others. I know when people, talk down to me or raise their voice at me, that's a big trigger for me. So what are things that you either feel or that are happening around you that you know make you stressed or escalated? The next one is warning signs, right? Or personal signs of burnout. So how would you know, or how would someone around you know that something isn't quite right, right? So is it that you start to breathe more quickly? Is it that you withdraw and become quiet, right? And you don't want to joke or talk to anybody? Do you notice that you start calling out more? You start taking more personal days, or you start to crave a specific food more often? So what are some things that you know you do, or your habits that show, okay, I'm not in the best space right now. I'm starting to get to a burned out level. Maybe I should do something about it. Then again, the next couple of boxes are the things that we've talked about, right? So I put five on each of these boxes. You do not have to fill out all five. If you just have one in each box, that's great. But these are where you're going to take from some of those strategies. And so we have the slides in the chat as well. That way you can refer back to them while you're working on this slide. But this is where you're going to put those strategies, right? And again, you don't have to put all five. You don't have to try everything all at once, just what works for you, right? And so if you know you're working on having more snacks with you during the day, great, put that under basic needs, right? Or if you're saying, I've really been thinking about going to therapy, then great, put that under psychological needs. Or if you're thinking, I really don't know if I'm still connected to this job or what I want to do, then under self-fulfillment needs, you can put, think about my own vision and for the role. So all that Cheesecake Factory menu of strategies that I reviewed, this is where you can kind of pick and choose what you think might work best for you and put them into your plan. And then the final one is support system. So who are some people that you want to rely on or maybe share this plan with so that when if they see your warning signs or if they see your triggers, they can check in on you and see how you're doing, or they know what strategies work best for you so they can encourage you to say, "Hey, do you want to go meditate together?" Or, do you want to go do yoga together? Or, whatever it is, who are some people that you can share this plan with? Ideally someone at work, and at home, that way you're having support in both places, but whatever works best for you. This oftentimes we think about this in the moment and then we forget it, right? So hopefully this is a chance for you to write everything out, put it on paper, and then keep it in a space where you'll be able to see it, right? Don't just put it in a folder or leave it in your downloads folder on your computer and never look at it again, right? Having it posted so you can come back to it. So I'm going to stop talking. I'm going to give you 10 minutes to just really think through this, work on it. I'm going to put on some calm music for you. And if you have any questions or there's something I can help you with, feel free to, you can either unmute yourself if you want everyone to hear or send me a direct message. I'm happy to consult on, strategies or whatever. So I'll go ahead and give you some work time and we'll come back in 10 minutes. Okay, so I think at the end of this video, the alarm is very, very loud, so I didn't want it to go off and frighten you. So we are at the end of our work time. We have a couple more minutes. I would love to hear any thoughts that came up as you were working on your self-care plan, maybe things that were a little difficult for you. You don't have to share out, specifics about it. You don't have to, this is personal for you, but just any thoughts that came up or things that you noticed about creating this plan for yourself. It's hard. Yeah, having those boundaries with holding on the same boundaries we would hold with other people, holding them with ourselves too, right? Like, no, I said I'm going to stop here, so I'm going to stop. But yeah, that follow through is always so hard. It's easy, of course, to sit, and create a plan, but actually using it in the moment and putting it into practice is incredibly hard. So the fact that you all are just here and already working on it is a great step. So thank you so much for that comment. And I think sometimes writing out what you're experiencing or what you're going through can be so powerful because we kind of take for granted, like we just go, 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 not realizing how much is actually on our plate, right? And so for you to write it all out and to get to see, okay, I actually do need to take care of myself because these things are happening. I'm glad you're able to get that point of reflection. I want to just draw your attention again in the slides. There are some trainings that we have that are kind of connected to some of the things we've talked about today. We had a really great self-care series over the summer, so definitely check out these trainings. These are some books that I found to be really helpful when thinking about just kind of vicarious trauma and burnout and self-care. Also some kind of assessments that you can use either with yourself or maybe with your staff to assess where people are at in terms of burnout and self-care. So there are some resources for that. References, the boring stuff, if anyone is interested. Thank you all so much. I really appreciate your engagement. You made this training so lively. So I really appreciate it. Hopefully you found things that were helpful for you, and definitely take care of yourself. So I hope to see you again in one of our future trainings. Thanks, everyone.